Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Refractive Thinker Radio Show, hosted by the award-winning and international best-selling author Dr. Cheryl Lentz, the academic entrepreneur. Meet the scholars of the award-winning doctoral anthology series, The Refractive Thinker, where we focus on getting doctoral research off the coffee table and into the hands of business owners who can benefit from the results. Join us each Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. Mountain Standard Time for 30 minutes of thought-provoking radio designed to discuss emerging topics in higher education and business. We will meet today's industry thought leaders and college professors leading the way. Details can be found at www.refractivethinker.com. Now, here's your host, Dr. Cheryl Lentz. Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Dr. Cheryl Lentz, the academic entrepreneur. I'm not quite sure where our bumper is this morning, but we're going to start without it. Happy New Year. Sometimes we have to look at digital technology as an interesting form. So welcome to Tuesday morning. I am Dr. Cheryl Lentz, the academic entrepreneur, and this morning we have Dr. Mac McClellan, one of our newest Refractive Thinker authors. So welcome to the show, Dr. McClellan. How are you?
Thanks, Cheryl. I appreciate it. Sitting here in Dubai, enjoying the nice weather compared to what I know a lot of people there in the U.S. are going through.
Yes, it's 'tis the season. We had actually snow in Albuquerque, just enough for dusting. We don't often get a lot of snow, but just enough to wreak a little bit of havoc in the city. So we're glad to have you. It's interesting to have our international contingent with us. So as we start every show, let's go ahead and tell our listeners a little bit about you and your background.
Okay. As you said, I'm Mac McClellan. First, I'm the CEO of Center House Limited, a management consulting firm based in Dubai, covering the region generally from South Africa to Singapore for our clients, depending on who they are and what their needs are. I'm a retired Marine Corps officer. I served 20 years as an infantry officer and have been the managing director for Enron Middle East, director of the Eastern Hemisphere for J. Ray McDermott, a marine construction company. So both private sector and public sector experience and have been here in Dubai for the last 20 years.
Fantastic. Tell us a little bit about your research and your interest in how this particular field came to be for you. It's always interesting to not only look at the research, but why we do what we do, because a lot of our listeners, particularly students who listen to the show, are interested in, well, how do you pick a topic? What got your excitement? What piqued your interest? And strategically looking at how your research is really going to further your career to not just pick a topic to check the box, but to pick a topic that's really going to serve your interest going forward.
Cheryl, you know, as a Marine Corps officer, I was involved in a handful of evacuations of American citizens and others out of conflict areas, particularly in the Middle East. And so after retiring, as I said earlier, I went to work for J. Ray McDermott, a marine construction company out of Houston and New Orleans, working the Eastern Hemisphere out of Dubai and out of Singapore and then the surrounding countries, and then found that Enron had not yet opened a Middle East office. So I went to Houston, met with them, and in the discussions helped them understand why a major American energy company needed to have an office in the Middle East. And so did that for a couple of years until the company collapsed. I had nothing to do with the collapse and lost everything with everybody else, but then opened my consulting firm, Center House Limited, originally intending to be energy and security consulting based on my experience in the Marine Corps and then in the private sector. And got the company set up, licensed in August of 2001, and then 9/11 hit. And all of the clients who would be looking for management consulting, business development, government relations, marketing, those sort of things, were instead looking for safe haven for all of their employees and their employees' families. And so, of course, my knees got cut out from underneath me. I was on track to have several clients beginning either September 1st or October 1st when 9/11 happened. Those that had already signed walked away, and the ones that I was counting on to begin the 1st of October just said, let's just put it on hold for now. So I found, after having been devastated in the Enron collapse financially, looking to use my skills here in the Middle East, suddenly had no clients. And then a couple of weeks after 9/11, an American company called and said, hey, weren't you in the military? Don't you know something about emergency action, crisis action plans, things like that? And I said, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I did a lot of that when I was in the Marine Corps. And so for the...
Mac, are you still there? If you give us a few moments, technology is obviously being an interesting foe this morning. We'll see, give it a couple of minutes to have Mac call back in. As we're waiting, we want to be able to look at some of the opportunities that you have had for considering actions as a result of 9/11. As we're experiencing technical issues today, Mac has been offering us the ability to look at how things will move forward when you have plans and national catastrophes have absolutely adjusted those plans. And I think we might have Mac back here, so let's take a look.
I apologize, but calling in from overseas, we often get kicked off the line. So can you hear me okay now?
Absolutely, Mac. Welcome back. Sure, continue.
Okay, so for the year immediately following 9/11, I ended up consulting to several companies to work with them on their crisis action planning, emergency action planning, helping them identify and equip safe houses if they had to move their employees and families closer to the airport or the port. Where they would go, what they would do, how they would organize themselves, how they would communicate, you know, all those sort of things that, again, we don't necessarily think about until something happens and we have to do it for real. And so that occupied most of my time, and it kept me going financially until companies were ready to start looking at traditional consulting again. And so as I prepared to do my doctorate and looking at a dissertation topic, I thought, well, you know, the American companies here in, let's say, Dubai and Abu Dhabi, the United Arab Emirates, most of them don't have professional crisis managers on their teams here in the region. The big companies will have a crisis action team or a crisis response team sitting in the States somewhere, or maybe in their European headquarters that covers the Middle East, but they generally don't have people on their staff who are trained to do that. And so the idea was, how can I benefit companies by helping them understand the roots of crises, how to organize themselves to monitor the local environment or the environment that could affect their operations, and then to help them through the research find some ways to mitigate the circumstances that they find themselves in. And a case in point, without, I won't mention the company's name, but their U.S. headquarters and European regional headquarters, the U.S. branch had hired some people for this region. The European headquarters had hired some people. At one point, their India operation came under their Far East headquarters, who had hired some people. And then the local team, once they set up an office here in Dubai, had hired people in several of the countries around here, including the one in India. And then through a reorganization, suddenly the guy here in Dubai was responsible for all of the Arab countries, Sub-Saharan Africa, India, and some of the stands. And so he found himself owning people, owning employees and families who he had never met, didn't know. They were being paid by different pay centers. And when 9/11 happened, he realized he didn't know where these people were. And so,
you know what, Matt,
with that company...
Let me step in for here, just a minute to interrupt, because we focused on this interesting point before with many interesting findings from research, meaning crisis tends to get people off the dime to be able to look at, as you mentioned, only having people in the United States as tentacles out into the world instead of actually boots on the ground. And the question is, why? I've been amazed. We had somebody on the show, a few months ago that had the same problems with succession planning with all the baby boomers. It's not exactly a newsflash that we and the baby boomers have known they've been retiring en masse for decades. And many of the municipalities, government entities in particular, simply were flying by the seat of their pants saying, you know what, we know, and we're not going to do anything about it because it costs too much money to plan, and we're just going to kind of handle it as it happens. And both of us sat there going, really? And then they act surprised when some things didn't quite go into plan because they didn't have a plan to start with. And so it sounds like there's a little bit of this here perpetuating that until crisis happened, people either didn't think about or chose not to because they didn't have to. What do you think was in play here?
Well, I think it's all of the above, and the fact that they believe that the crisis action team sitting in Boston or Washington or San Francisco or wherever they are can come over and, you know, solve the problem on the spot. If you think about it, trying to get a crisis response team from the U.S. out here is just on the air travel and everything is a 15 to 17 hour trip. Once they get here, they don't know the lay of the land. They don't know the people. They don't know the local authorities who could help them, the police, the interior department, the equivalent of the, you know, the FBI. They don't know the environment from an information standpoint, where they can get information, how they can work with different people, including in the case of American companies, who's the regional security officer at the embassy or the consulate that's closest to them. And you also have to remember that the regional headquarters here in Dubai may have employees in Kuwait, and in the case of 9/11, did have employees in Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Oman, Bahrain, Tunisia, Morocco, you know, and had to prepare to move people from a dozen different locations, possibly simultaneously, and so a crisis management team coming in from the States is overwhelmed from day one. And so that's why it's so important that the local team, the people who work in the regional headquarters anyway, are prepared, double-hatted, if you will, trained to act as that crisis management team until the professional guys are able to come in and do that.
You're saying, Mac, but I'm still a little bit surprised that this isn't the first rodeo. This isn't our first conflict in the world at an international scale. Aren't these lessons that were learned decades ago, if not centuries ago, for some countries that you understand the difference between being in the ground and not having, you know, external forces, that you need to have somebody in country who actually has eyes on the situation despite digital technology and all of that? I don't know why this seems to be such a new lesson that's being learned, since this seems to be a bit of a historical, isn't it?
Absolutely, and particularly I use the Middle East both in my dissertation and in the talk that we're doing right now, because I've been living out here, you know, almost 40 years. I grew up in Libya, you know, my teenage years in Libya, and then have lived in or worked in every Arab country, plus a lot of the peripheral states. You know, and as a matter of fact, we lived in Libya when in 1969 Gaddafi took over, overthrew the king, and took over the government, and you know, and so we went through it then. And since 1969, I've been in Lebanon through the civil war there. I've been in South Sudan during the civil war with the North. Have been in numerous instances when I was in the Marine Corps, of conflict areas in Palestine and Lebanon and in you know, Kuwait during Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and you see this time and time again. The State Department at every embassy and consulate has an emergency action plan, but by and large, the private sector, American companies and people, don't. Now, some of that has been overcome by the embassy forming this overseas security advisory in most cities, most of the major cities, certainly the capitals, where they work with the American companies and American individuals to help them think about things like that. But it's still a challenge, because the cost of training a crisis management team is too much for a local regional office to bear. The cost to bring the team out from the U.S., you know, if you figure four people coming in, they'll have to be on the ground for 6 to 8 weeks at least before they're able to function effectively, you know, and they're in hotels and they have rental cars and they're, you know, and so the cost to do that drives into the hundreds of thousands of dollars that, you know, companies are reluctant to spend unless they absolutely have to. And so having those local teams trained and ready to go, at least as a filler until the corporate guys can come in, is an interim solution at least. And so in answer to your question, though, companies think about it when they have to. Normally, the offices out in the region, such as here, are sales and marketing offices. They're normally, at least for American companies, they're not manufacturing anything. You know, they're providing a marketing arm for the corporate headquarters in the region with marketing that is tailored to the local market, sensitive to either political or religious needs, and a sales team that works with the local agents who are selling software or widgets or whatever, working with them to help them sell more. And so the sales and marketing CEO out here is not thinking about operations, is not thinking about HR or, you know, employee benefits or anything like that. He's thinking about sales and marketing. And so when something happens, he looks to the headquarters back in, you know, Boston to say, okay, do this. Here's the checklist, 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, sometimes a little bit of foresight, some presence on what's going on based on the information that's available locally will have told that regional CEO, you need to move some of your people out of the way now before it becomes a problem. And so that's why they think about it, but they think about it only when they have to. And that's usually when the crisis has already happened.
And that seems to be almost a human nature, not logistics withstanding, meaning the cost and the integration. I mean, we looked at just the lessons from 9/11 with the right hand not talking to the left hand of something as simple as communications for first responders. And it just seems that those basic type of understandings would not be such a factor in 2000, you know, in the 21st century, when we have been reinventing this wheel seemingly over and over. And it seems that logistically, when cost is a factor, we've always talked about it, it's not that we lack the ability to, or even the design to, or the technology to. A lot of it does come down the ability to have unlimited resources, and most people simply don't have a blank check. So, cool. Let's look at move on to the idea of that research that prompted your what your dissertation offers and what the results were that might be able to help in situations such as this.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I remembered as a Marine Corps officer is going into either a combat or a almost combat operation is that by and large the embassy might be ready for evacuation, but the private sector isn't. They don't know what it entails. It's like, you know, I've got my dog with me. We want to take our maid with us, you know, all these sort of things. And so as part of my research, what I tried to do was to help identify those things that companies would need to do to prepare for evacuation by themselves, either in my consulting to help them contract an airplane, you know, or a ship, or map out a route overland in vehicles to get to a friendly country, those sort of things, or to be prepared with your employees and their families to be evacuated by, in the case of American companies, the U.S. military. And so those evacuations from the military standpoint are called non-combatant evacuation operations. Non-combatants, people who aren't involved in the combat but are just caught in the middle of whatever's happening. So during the Arab Spring, there were non-combatant evacuation operations, or NEOs, throughout the Middle East. You know, Tunisia when it first happened, Egypt, Libya, you know, and so as these things started happening, Syria being kind of the final case, people didn't know what they were supposed to do, what they were supposed to bring, how they were supposed to act, what documents they needed, all those sort of things. And then as the local governments collapsed, communication was curtailed or completely eliminated. How did they communicate? How did they set up a warden network that to inform each other within the American community to be prepared for that evacuation and then move to the designated location to do it? So in my research, I wanted, again, to make sure that people understood what constituted a crisis. And so some of those are natural disasters, you know, the tsunami, earthquakes, you know, the volcanoes that erupt and things like that. But also the human-induced or the man-made crises that don't necessarily require an evacuation but threaten the business continuity of the American company. So the CFO who embezzles money, or the CEO who has a relationship with one of the employees that comes to light and the media jumps on it. You know, things like that happen, and how to be prepared for them, and then how to mitigate the damage, you know, reduce loss of life and limb, continue business either, you know, on site, or move the business to a secure or neutral location, and to be able, you know, to have that business continuity. And so that's what I was looking at, is what do companies do? And I used a modified Delphi to set up a panel of experts, people here in the UAE, as it turns out, members of the American Business Council in Dubai, or the American Chamber of Commerce in Abu Dhabi, men and women who were senior in their companies, senior in their organizations, and who had been through, you know, one or more crises over the last few years. For what it's worth, we seem to be going through crises in the Middle East at least every year. There's something different. You know, right now it's the price of oil as low as it is, that's causing unrest in a lot of these countries that rely on that oil revenue. 2 weeks ago, let's see, we're in the middle of January 2016 right now. 2 weeks ago, the fire in the Address Hotel down near Burj Khalifa, the tallest building in the world, you know, on New Year's Eve, a fire broke out in this 64-story hotel, and they had to evacuate people out of the building, and then if they had left their passports in there and those got destroyed, how to get them to their embassies, get new passports, all the logistics of getting these people out of harm's way. And so we do tend to go through a lot of crises out here in the Middle East.
And that, again, reiterates the idea for me that why do we seemingly reinvent the wheel when this would provide opportunities, not even just in practice situation, but practicing during the real thing, from which lessons could be learned, from which crises could be far better managed. Do we simply have short memories? Do we simply not have the ability for others who are involved in the crisis to remember? I mean, I remember living overseas with the U.S. military as a spouse, and I remember the cultural briefings once we got in country that were immensely helpful, but I don't remember anything being truly other than if something happens, go contact your base commander or, you know, the consulate if you get in trouble, but nothing more detailed than that. So when the crisis might happen, and we were involved in a tsunami and a few other things, that we didn't have those types of skills other than they were cursorily mentioned in a cultural briefing as being a member in, you know, in a foreign country, but we would not have been adequately prepared, and we were members of the military. You know, that to me still staggers the imagination that there's such a lack of preparation.
Well, let's call it knowledge management. Again, I point to the U.S. embassies because the embassies and the consulates are able to, using State Department regional security staff, to come help them write their emergency action plan and then practice it regularly, regardless of the changes in personnel that happen every 2 or 3 years in the embassy. The private sector, you know, the senior people, by and large, are American citizens. They don't want to be gone from their homes in South Carolina or Texas for 20 years. They want to come out here for 2 or 3 years, get the international experience, and then go back to wherever they came from. And so it is difficult for knowledge management purposes to maintain, first to draft that emergency action plan, rehearse it in a meaningful way, and then to keep it current. The next, you know, CEO or managing director comes in, and it's like, I don't have time for that. I need to do more sales than my predecessor so that I get the next promotion, et cetera. I found a great quote that I used in my dissertation that talks about expatriate workers and their accompanying families must have the stamina of an Olympic runner, the mental agility of an Einstein, the detachment of a judge, the tact of a diplomat, and the perseverance of an Egyptian pyramid builder to navigate successfully through the local environment. Now, apart just a second. Yeah, you know, for Americans coming to the Middle East, as Western as Dubai is, for instance, it's still an Arab country. And, you know, the national language is Arabic. The national religion is Islam. Things are different than they are in the States. I can't tell you the number of times with my clients where, you know, somebody would say, well, this isn't the way we do it in Houston. And I'd have to tell them, I'd have to remind them, we're not in Houston. And you are not going to teach, you know, the government here how to do business. They do it their way. You're going to have to adapt legally, morally, and ethically, you know, to do business with them in a way that doesn't violate, you know, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act or any of the other things that you know, American companies are bound to. But you're going to have to adjust to the local culture. Well, if you're just in here for 2 or 3 years and your main objective is to sell more airplanes or more, you know, whatever it is to the government or the private sector, you're not real interested in those sort of things that take time away from you and put things on your desk that prevent you from doing what you came out here to do. And so that perseverance of an Egyptian pyramid builder is so apropos. People get out here and they get inundated with their day-to-day jobs. And by the time they figured it out, they're rotating to another job somewhere else in the corporation and leaving. And so it is frustrating. But I'll tell you, with my consulting clients, right after 9/11, the plan was put in place and exercised regularly. And for some of them, for almost 10 years, I would go back quarterly and do an exercise with them where they went through the process of an evacuation or crisis management with their regional headquarters and their U.S. headquarters. And some of them got very good at it, despite the fact that their management had turned over two or three times in those 10 years.
Do you think, Mac, this becomes a leadership issue then in terms of, because I know a lot of the analysis, if you will, from the lessons learned from 9/11 came down to, it's not that we didn't have a plan, but it wasn't exactly adaptable because nobody had anticipated such like this, but that there were sometimes a gap in leadership for those who really had not had experience in a crisis. And there's one thing to be said for what you think you will do and quite another when what actually happens and it unfolds. Is leadership an issue as part of this?
Absolutely. It's a leadership challenge, you know, to prepare for and respond to crisis situations will result in better outcomes. And so a leader who takes it seriously will be better prepared if and when something happens to respond to it. It may not prevent, you know, deaths, for instance, but it'll reduce the number of casualties. It will reduce the damage to the company's reputation or financial standing. It will reduce the issues that the company has to deal with post-crisis. And so, yeah, it definitely is a leadership issue. Knowing who your people are, where they are, you know, their families. Think about, again, I'll use Dubai because that's where I'm sitting right now, and that's where I've been for the last 20 years. A company with a staff of 250 people might have 50 or 60 different nationalities working there. And so all of the expatriates, you know, everybody other than the Emirati citizens are here on a residence visa and a work permit. And just making sure that your HR department is prepared, you know, with proper planning to make sure that their visas are current, that their passports are not expiring in 2 weeks, you know, things like that, that if you have to do an evacuation would complicate things if those, all of those documents aren't current. How many family members are here? If they're not here, where are those family members? If you have to move the employee to a safe haven in Europe, let's say, and the family returns to India because, you know, they can't go to Europe. You can get a visa, a Schengen visa for the employee, but not for the family members. So they go home to India. The employee goes to Geneva. How do you pay the employee in Geneva who's not going to have a bank account there, and make sure that the family is taken care of in India, that part of the pay goes there? So all of that is a leadership challenge to make sure that you are prepared for the worst case, not for the best case, not for the day in and day out that companies go through.
Absolutely. It's just a matter of a lot of little details that ideally, and we often talk, is first you plan your work, then you work your plan. And preparation is truly the key, is that you can't possibly be prepared for all possible contingencies, but you can at least have a roadmap so you're not making it up as you go along. So as we bring this show to a close, Mac, let's look at, say, the advice you would have for folks, because we could spend at least another hour probably discussing this, but see if you can't kind of call it down for a little bit. Is what would be the top two or three pieces of advice that you might offer our listeners of what might you be able to do, and then please follow that up with how they can contact you for further information.
Okay. The preparation is the key, and you know, we say that about a lot of things. In overseas locations like this, where information is not as easily available as it is in the States, let's say, where when you ask a question, depending on how you ask it, the answers will be different. You're dealing with people whose native language is not English, and you may be working through an interpreter who, you know, again, English is not a native language, but they're acting, you know, in your stead to talk to the police or the Ministry of Interior or whatever. Being prepared, rehearsing, as you said, plan it and then rehearse it and adapt your plan as changes happen in the local market is key to a successful outcome. If you're not prepared for the crisis, when it happens, you can't be ready for it. It just, things get out of control too quickly. And so it is accepting the fact that as the senior person from whatever your company is or organization, you're responsible for everything that your organization does or fails to do. And in the case of a crisis, it's on you to help respond to it in a way that's successful. It's on your...
I would assume that in a crisis is not the time to learn.
No, it's on your shoulders to train your people to act as that crisis management team with backups and you know, somebody goes on vacation, who steps in to take the job? You can't run your people 24/7, and so you have to have two or three teams at least who are trained to take the job from each other for, you know, 8, 10, 12 hours, and then the next team comes on. So all those things are definitely leadership challenges, and it's something that you can't shirk. The second thing is to understand your local environment, understand where you get information, call on the people who you will have to rely on, and then finally, and since this is the refractive thinker, prepare your organization for that evacuation should it come by meeting the people at the U.S. Embassy or, you know, the foreign embassy if you're a foreign company, meeting those people within the military organizations at the embassy who will be responsible for helping to get you out and understanding what are their needs of you to make the process go smoother. For contact information, the easiest way to reach me is by email. I'm at mac@centerhouseltd.com. That's centerhouseltd.com. That's the easiest way to reach me. Mobile in the United Arab Emirates is 971-50-651-2472. And we're East Coast during standard time. We're 9 hours later than the East Coast of the United States. So if you call me and it's the middle of my night, I'll call you the next day when you're awake.
Well, I think this has been fascinating, Mac. Again, everyone, I want to be able to thank Dr. Mac McLennan, a recent member of the Refractive Thinker. We just had our new volume coming out, which is Volume 10, Effective Business Strategies for the Defense Area Sector. General Fogelman, former Joint Chief of Staff, wrote our foreword for us. And part of this is really interesting as I'm listening to you. We've had several guests on the show, Matt, about that idea of preparation. And there's a lot of fundamentals that we were definitely going to have you back. Because the fundamentals of leadership, of preparation, of understanding your environment, understanding your people, looking at a variety of things are amazing. I remember Dr. Sheila Embry was on about 6 months ago, and she had the same thing that they have this, I think she calls it a red book, the fact that it's not people specific, it's role specific. So if you are not there that day, someone can slide into what needs to be done, even if you aren't the one to do it. And even if you're not well trained, you're at least cross trained to know that you could slide in for an afternoon, because it's not a, I'm sorry, they're not here and they can't do your job, call them next week. It's a, you're in a crisis, figure it out, here's the checklist, and start going in there. So there's this, what you mentioned earlier, this continuity within the crisis situation, so that you have a higher probability of success regardless of what happens. So we want to be able to thank you so much for joining us. These lessons are just amazing that we can look to, whether it was Hurricane Katrina, 9/11, or the hotel that was just in Dubai, depending on where it is. So we appreciate these lessons, and we'll continue to look at these 30,000-foot view of fundamentals, and they're called that for a reason. So thank you, everyone, for joining us today. I am Dr. Cheryl Lentz, the academic entrepreneur. You're listening to Blog Talk Radio for the Refractive Thinker. We will look forward to seeing you next week, 9 a.m. Mountain Standard Time. And until then, keep thinking your way to success. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Mack. Have a good one. Be safe.
Thanks. Bye-bye.